This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. And my guest today is Jason Silva, a Venezuelan-American filmmaker, futurist, and television personality, known for his viral videos, Shots of Awe, as well as a National Geographic TV show that was nominated for Emmys called Brain Games. But you've left the old world of cable and, kind of 20th century video behind. You exist on social media. You exist everywhere. A juvenile delinquent is striving to break free of his mind. Your new book is The Ecstatic States of America. I want to talk to you about that. I want to talk to you about Venezuela. I want to talk to you about awe more than anything. Jason Silva, thanks for talking to Reason.
Wow. Well, thanks for having me, Nick. Yeah. And it feels like a full circle journey because I don't know if you recall, but Reason Magazine sat down with me and did this video interview, which I think was like 15 years ago or
it
something.
It was at least you were working at Current TV, right? Which is now, I don't think people remember it, but that was Al Gore's bid to get online and kind of deliver on the information superhighway, as he used to call it. So that was a while ago.
It was citizen journalism, short form media. And sorry, you were going to say something?
Well, let's get, I want to get to your biography and kind of your career or your wanderings, because you currently live in Amsterdam. You were born in Venezuela. All of this is fascinating stuff. But the new book, your first book, is called The Ecstatic States of America, A Manifesto for a New Country of the Mind. And I think when I first heard about this, I happened to be listening to a John Lennon song from Mind Games or whatever, like the Newtopian national anthem. He and Yoko Ono had it was just a silent track at the end of one of their albums. But it put me in mind of this, and you in this, the people you talk about that are your teachers are people like Terrence McKenna, the great advocate for magic mushrooms, Buckminster Fuller, Stuart Brand, Kevin Kelly, Ray Kurzweil, Peter Diamandis, etc. And you talk about the broad California lineage that holds the counterculture and the computer revolution as a single continuous gesture. This is catnip to Reason. It is catnip to me. What are the ecstatic states of America?
Thank you for having me. The book is a labor of love. I've never been a political person. I've never been somebody that's advocating for like societal transformation. I've always kept it focused on the individual. My interest in mental health, my interest in human flourishing, my interest in flow states and human performance is sort of like, sort of hack yourself so you can operate in the world better. But the Ecstatic States of America, I don't know, it just kind of came out fully formed as an opportunity to provide a map forward as we stand at this very interesting transformational moment, this feeling of vertigo that everybody's experiencing with the rise of AI, the geopolitical wildness, the epistemic crisis, the crisis of sense making, the mental health crisis. And I just kind of feel like it reminds me a little bit of the turmoil of the 1960s. It just feels like we need an anthem that brings us together. Come on, people, now smile on your brother. Everybody get together, try to love one another right now. My mom was of the 60s. And I sort of grew up surrounded by that sort of counterculture, peace and love, the values of like, what if we could like catalyze a transformation in our consciousness to address the ills of the world? So that there's that lineage that lives in me. And there's also been this kind of 15-year run as a sort of corporate speaker, a humanistic take on the technological singularity, like trying to get everybody excited about exponential technology and the future, because I love tech or I love creativity and I kind of see tech as an extension of our creative possibilities. And so it turns out that these seemingly unrelated things actually are intertwined. They're braided together. And it's pretty much the California ideology. It's where the kind of human potential movement and the counterculture psychedelic movement at the early computer sort of revolution thing that started in the 60s. It's Stuart Brand. It's that great book, What the Dormouse Said, that chronicles this unique intersection. Yeah. And I just thought, like, we could have another kind of version of that could maybe give rise to an update on the California ideology and what that might look like and how we can use it to get us back on track.
Yeah, let me ask you, because a lot of people right now on the right and on the left, and for different reasons, they would say, you know, the problem was the California ideology and like the idea that you could retreat into yourself and that you could leave society and start a commune, or even more so journey into, you know, your own mind, perfect yourself, not care about the outside world, and then make lots of money, or, you know, and harness these high aspirations. People like Steve Jobs and in a different way, Bill Gates, they're the problem, because now they've created technologies that have enslaved us. And they're giving us soma, or, you know, pharmaceutical companies now are giving us prescription psychedelics and things like that to ease the pain. How, you know, and at one point you mentioned in the book, you know, that we tried this before. I mean, there was that countercultural moment, you know, that was heavily, you know, revolved around alternative ways of living, of saying no to a consumer culture that, you know, our parents or grandparents worked really hard after World War II to deliver to, you know, the early boomers. They said no. And then they took too many drugs. They listened to too much music and it faded. So how, you know, why are you positive about it when it seems like everybody is particularly negative about the tech part of it? Like, people are scared shitless of AI. And you're like, no, this is the thing that the 60s needed.
Yeah, no doubt. I think that what we've seen with social media has had some unintended consequences for sure that has left a nasty flavor in our tongues is an understatement. But I still think that, like, at its very best, technology extends our capacities in the world. I mean, the millions of people that I have reached with my video content, my reveries would not be possible without an infrastructure that supports the capacity to electrify our thoughts so that they can travel at the speed of light. I mean, it's like the sort of meme world that we live in today. And I also have this kind of idea that, you know, David Deutsch, he wrote The Beginning of Infinity, and he has these grand statements like, if you look at the topography of a modern city, that's a topography where the forces of economics and intentionality and creativity have trumped the forces of geology. So the human creative capacity to overcome boundaries, to transform the world, I still think gives us an existential place on which to stand that provides just inspiration and possibility at a time where there is this increasing feeling of nihilism. And I also kind of feel like in the face of mortality and in the face of death, everything becomes really just absurd. The whole enterprise is largely meaningless, except for our creative capacity, because that's the only place where we seemingly overcome any and all previous limits. With AI, we've taught sand how to think. Now, does that mean that AI couldn't be used to create an authoritarian 1984 surveillance state? Could happen. But could it also veer in the direction of, like, the imagination summoning its own literalization? And so I suppose that, like, the way we deploy this tool will be determined by the state of consciousness that we harvest, that determines the kind of compassion, the kind of vision, the kind of, yeah, orientation and posture that can move us forward. And so I think those things are intertwined. I mean, there's relentless progress, yet there's also this horrific mental health crisis. More people die now of suicide than from natural disasters and armed conflict combined, according to the World Health Organization. So wealthiest country in the history of the world, the West, so much material abundance, and yet there's this anxiety, there's this distress, there's this fear of the robots, but there's also fear of our own minds. But then you see this psychedelic revolution happening. You see people with PTSD being healed by single sessions in controlled environments. So I don't think we're done with psychedelics. I think when we went overboard in the 60s. Maybe we had the wrong frameworks or we got over our heads, but it just feels like a psychedelic renaissance to address the mental health crisis, transhuman technologies that give us the power of gods. The power of gods will require the wisdom of gods, and the wisdom of gods will require the humility of dying egos that can give rise to some different perspective or state of being or state of consciousness. So it feels
can I
to
ask
me
then,
like the book is a summation of, yeah. of a moment of like clarifying, like kind of like visionary gnosis, you know, and I hope that doesn't sound like absurdly arrogant, but there is a feeling that, I don't know, that there was more to what was happening in the 60s. There was more to that collective effervescence. There was more to that feeling of fraternal connection, brotherhood, sisterhood, you know, Martin Luther King, soul force. Like, do you hear the people sing? It is a song of angry men. It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. Like, I can't help but get caught up in that kind of like, that feeling. And I'm trying to transmit that. Like, I want to like infect people with a sense of possibility, because there's two things that largely spread on the internet these days. And it's either like weaponized fear and outrage and clickbait, or there's awe, you know, which is like pro-social. And so it's just like, I just want to just get people on board the awe train, the possibility train. And that's
don't call it a train, right? A train is an old technology. There's a spaceship maybe or something, right?
Fair.
Or a transmigration of the soul. Yeah. Because what, you know, when you mentioned David Deutsch, who's, you know, a phenomenal thinker and is not as well known in the US as he is, I think, in Europe and the UK, but, you know, getting to that awe, like, every aspect of America, every aspect of the world is terraformed, right? Like there's no reason for life to be here. And then humans have created, and particularly starting a few hundred years ago in a big way, you know, started aggregating in cities and transforming, you know, just creating something that we now take for granted. And it seems to me, I want to talk about the role of drugs and psychedelics in kind of regaining awe and ecstasy, but also technology. And is it, you know, I'm talking to you from Hell's Kitchen in New York. You know, this is a place 100 years ago. My father was born in tenement buildings. It's still here, but it's radically different. And like to see it anew every day, part of it is like, do psychedelics help with that? Or, and if not drugs, other techniques and other rituals that help us understand that the world is amazing every moment that we're alive. Like, what's the role of drugs in generating awe out instead of fear or just boredom?
I know. I mean, I wish the word drugs wasn't such a trigger, because it sort of gets clumped together with two distinct categories. There's a guy called David Lenson. He's a comparative literature professor, which I think wrote the best book on drug phenomenology like ever written. So like from the perspective of the user, like really a book about subjectivity and mediating subjectivity through sort of intentional use of psychedelics or different transhuman technologies, as I like to call them. But he makes a distinction between drugs of desire and drugs of pleasure. And so drugs of desire, like things like cocaine, like you do cocaine and it just makes you want to do more cocaine and it just makes you want to do more cocaine. And he makes a very big distinction between that and the drugs of pleasure, which include cannabis and the psychedelics, which basically just kind of reset perception. And then it's really about the world itself, not about the drug, right? Like you take a psychedelic and it's not to take more of the psychedelic. You take the psychedelic because it cleanses the doors of perception, allows you to sort of perceive the world with a virginal noticing, right? Virginal noticing, the sense of the world. Michael Pollan in his book, Botany of Desire, had a great paragraph or a great chapter on the use of cannabis and how it re-virginizes perception. He used to speak about how it gives you, it catalyzes a sense of first sight, unencumbered by knowingness. And so knowingness is habituation, you know, which follows with the neurochemistry of the brain. It's sort of like you'd be overwhelmed if everything was new all the time. And so you sort of habituate so you can get things done. It's a sort of narrowing of perception and awareness. But the problem with habituation is it kind of makes you blind to the resplendent radiant mystery that surrounds us, right? Like yeah. We are chemical scum, but we are chemical scum, the dream of distant quasars, as David Deutsch used to say. You know, we're hanging off a planet, you know, vertiginous. No one knows what's going on. We're hurtling through space. I mean, it's sort of like, it depends on where you want to like focus your awareness. But I think that capacity to see things through the lens of awe, whether it's mediated through a little bit of cannabis use which, you know, thank God we're almost there in America. You know, Canada's there, the Netherlands are there. We're almost there. And my hope is that people use this tool really as a tonic to like reset perception, because that kind of like stop and smell the roses, that's sort of like reminder of the magic of a moment, of connection, of a piece of music that takes your breath away, of a film scene that transports you to like places of poetic rapture, you know, that take us out of the fetching water, chopping wood, narrow band, instrumental state of consciousness. And there's that Jewish mystic Martin Buber, which talks about the difference between I, it, and I, thou. You know, I, it is that instrumental consciousness, human beings reduced to their socioeconomic function. I'm the consumer, you are serving me, you are the Uber driver, you are. But then that leaves this hunger for like a deeper connection, for like a deeper mirroring. People go to Burning Man so they can hug strangers and cry because of how much they wish they could do that in their ordinary life, you know, right, without somebody calling
how
the cops.
How do you, let me, I am totally with you. And also I was just looking, you know, the federal government here just released the latest findings of the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, which comes out every couple of years. And for the first time ever, more people on a monthly basis are using marijuana than alcohol. So
how amazing.
But what is amazing to me, I find that very interesting. And also psychedelic use has tipped up a little bit. Most other drugs, things like cocaine to even opioids, they're declining. Illicit use, or what's considered illicit use of those, are declining. So we may be inching towards that, you know, that point that you're talking about. But then, you know, people are like, well, this is the problem. Because like marijuana use is going to destroy youth initiative. You know, young boys, young men now are just smoking weed and watching video games and jerking off in basement rather than going out and conquering the world. Why? And there's a right wing version of that and a left wing version of that, right?
But yeah.
Why is that wrong? Tell me, you know, I'm on your side, but steal me on that argument.
Two things. The numbers apparently are that teen use has not been rising with legalization.
Right.
I think you hear some headlines where they're maybe buying like those unregulated hemp products and gas stations with a crazy amount of THC and then eating it. So that's just like poor literacy, you know, a lack of understanding of how these compounds work, and that's reckless behavior. So that's of course a problem. But then the larger question is, I think people have a misunderstanding of how psychedelic compounds work. You know, they're kind of like a placebo with booster rockets. I once heard, I think, Michael Pollan say that. But the real role is to give you a sense of authorship over your experience by curating the set and setting in which you use the compound. People have to understand feedback loops. They really didn't understand this idea of ontological design. And I know there's a literacy around this because we don't have initiatory practices in America that teach people how to use visionary plants. But the basic idea with ontological design is that everything that you design is designing you back. You know, you decorate your room in a certain way, that's kind of informing your mood. The architecture of your house is kind of shaping whether you feel like you have agency or whether your agency is thwarted. Like everything that surrounds you, landscapes, they sort of shape your inner life. And what something like cannabis or psychedelics do is that they dehabituate you, first of all, and then they let the larger context in which you dwell act upon you much more viscerally and at a state of pure awareness. You can feel it acting upon you. So that's where, if somebody's going to use something like cannabis to like reset themselves from their malaise, what they should really do is go to some national park in a place where cannabis is legal, prepare an excellent playlist, set an intention with a friend, and then kind of like step into that context that they've built. That maybe that's a very sophisticated kind of literacy that has to be understood by people. But I think if you do that, what you have is a tool that like reliably returns you into the deep now. The Greeks used to distinguish between Chronos and Kairos. Chronos is life by the clock, appointment viewing, the thing that runs Western civilization. Kairos is poetic time, the perfect moment, the moment that takes your breath away, the moment that lasts forever. And the moments, by the way, that we can harvest to heal the mental health crisis, in my opinion, because often the crisis of meaninglessness is because you haven't had a moment in which a sunset moved you to tears. A moment of meaninglessness can be cured by a song that gives you the goosebumps, or by a moment that seemingly felt like being a child again. Like it was like, oh my God, I was back to the endless summer. I was back to that kind of rhapsodic, italicized mode of perception. And so what I think is crazy is that we live in a world where people are purchasing quick dopamine fixes, right? Buy the next thing and you get like a high that starts to deplete immediately. Buy the new car, you know, by the second week, you're already bored of it. But in some ways, like the cheapest access to revivify perception maybe is less about the new shiny new thing with dopamine, but about like resetting the beautiful landscape that surrounds you that you didn't know how to pay attention to anymore. So
I totally understand. And the book, The Ecstatic States of America, is helps to kind of frame this and create not a specific, you know, kind of playlist of the mind, but it will help people understand this is how you can use drugs, not to take the edge off, but rather to relax and find purpose and reset and things like that. I just wanted to ask you though, like what, you talk in passing and other places about how like, and a lot of people talk about this, that, you know, the psychedelic revolution or the psychedelic aspects of the counterculture failed for a variety of reasons, partly because it was too soon, but what must it have been like to take LSD before the Beatles released Revolver? I mean, because like right now, you and I, and obviously, you know, we're conversant in these worlds, but, you know, we have like a half century of experience and mythology and scientific discussion, you know, about it, and best-selling books like Michael Pollan, you know, talking about this stuff. But what, I mean, of course the psychedelic revolution was going to fail in 1966, because it's like you are going from a world where even rock stars, I mean, like, you know, the Rolling Stones were still wearing jackets and ties when they played songs.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're just overwhelmed.
Yeah. I mean, I suspect that back then it was disruptive because there was no context in which to take them and understand them. I suppose what people could have used back then, which Timothy Leary kind of eventually came around to that, which was like mystical texts, you know, like Gnostic texts from way back. Hermetic texts, you know, and then somehow you look at those and you're like, oh, these people were tripping balls. Like, this is the iconography that might have served us in the 50s. But I also think that, again, because that these compounds are so, they're extraordinarily sensitive to the context in which we take them, even the name of the experience could have like determined the contents of the experience. So when we used to call them psychotomimetics, those were psychosis-inducing drugs. That's
right.
So you name it that, you know. But to name is also to condemn in some ways. You know, you're like, you're taking a psychosis-inducing drug. This is a placebo on booster rockets, and then you're giving it to somebody in some fluorescent lit room and you're staring at them like you're taking notes to see if they're going to start acting in a way that sounds deviant. You're basically concocting a bad trip. Like, you're creating a David Lynchian or Kafkaesque nightmare even before the compound kicks in. But I think what's interesting is that we sort of organically figured that out, because what eventually did lead to the Beatles and to Woodstock and Peace and Love and the narratives and the kaleidoscopic colors. It's like eventually there was an understanding that this stuff is a lot more fun if the context in which we take it is sort of steering the experience towards rainbow vibes, towards awe and wonder, towards love, peace and love. In a sense, because the compounds increase reactivity and receptivity, the shadow side is that it can be weaponized. It's kind of like collective effervescence. You know, Emily Durkheim talks a lot, that feeling that you have, that brotherhood, that connection, that fraternity that happens at a rock concert when people are together, their boundaries disappear. We know that can be weaponized. Certain politicians will bring people into a fever dream. You know, you watch footage of World War II, you know, when Hitler was talking, and it's frightening. But the most terrifying part is that the frenzy of the people in the audience was the same as the frenzy of people watching, you know, the Beatles, you know? And so there's something the shadow, and then you introduce psychedelics, which I guess increase suggestibility and receptivity. You see where these compounds could be easily weaponized, and so that's where we need leadership. You know, where we need singers and prophets and poets. You know, and Vaclav Havels. You know, former playwrights running for office. Like, I mean, this is where my romantic spirit just feels like we could do this. We just need the right orators. You know, I remember when Obama kind of came into the world stage, like he was in a way the most beatific vision of like the Yes We Can anthem. It was like, wow, eloquent, inspiring, you know, like representative of possibility. Like I was like, what a beautiful narrative. Like you could critique his policies and everything like that. Yeah. But there was something about his campaign that had that
hope and change. Yeah, that was.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's
and that's not the feeling now. Yeah. The feeling now doesn't feel like hope and change. It feels like demonizing and othering and suspicious of the other and outrage and clickbait. And I actually think it's like breaking people's brains, you know, at least online.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about. I want to come back to politics because there's a lot of interest to talk about, especially. You know, one of Timothy Leary's books was titled The Politics of Ecstasy. We'll get there in a second. As a small L libertarian, I'm always suspicious of politics because it always ends up, you know, it's, you know, some people who have guns tell other people how to live. And, you know, it, even in the best of circumstances. But let's talk about technology, because one of the other things that is, you know, America writ large, and certainly the West seems to be, you know, getting more and more comfortable with the idea of using drugs as a way to make yourself feel better or think better, and not in this Aldous Huxley, you know, not in a Brave New World like Soma way. We're not soporific anymore. Now we're using this to intensify our vision, to clarify our vision. But AI in particular is in such a negative light. In the U.S. polls have it, you know, Donald Trump is more popular than AI, you know, so it's like, you know, it is not popular. Talk about the, you know, the, why you see AI as like a good thing and not something that is the next technology that will enslave humans into thinking this way or that way, which is always the fear, right? Of technology.
Well, I suppose that if I go upstream a little bit, and I would say the technology itself is sort of astounding. Like it kind of takes your breath away. Like what it can be used for fills me with awe, but potentially it can also be used in ways that fill me with dread. So first there's just the technical achievement. Already we should like sort of take a bow. Like what we have achieved, how these neural nets work, how these generative systems work, the fact that they largely self-organize, you know, once you feed them enough data, they start to exhibit like emergent effects, should make us like have these kind of interesting metaphysical, introspective, philosophical questions about like, are we creating it or are we unleashing it? Are we discovering it? Is it a force of nature? Is it like learning to harness electricity? Is it like learning to harness magnetism? Was this just this invisible thing, you know, or that existed in biological substrates and biological lives, but now it's becoming like tap water. Like we're figuring out how to harness force. That's already like a profound conversation, you know? And I don't know if you've read much about how these systems work and how they organize information, these LLMs, but they work in this thing called the multidimensional latent space. Kevin Kelly from Wired Magazine wrote a fabulous Substack about how latent space works. It has over 500 dimensions. So it's like a mathematical universe where language has like a traversable shape. It takes the semantic relationships, which is the connections and associations between words, and turns them into geometric relationships. And then the interesting thing is that the shape of language matches across different languages, which is also really like trippy and weird. Like Japanese and the US, like the regions in the language where certain concepts live in that latent space are similar across different languages. So it's like, it feels like we're uncovering a natural phenomenon and getting to look at ourselves in a new way by creating AI or unleashing AI. So there's that. Okay. So that I think is already like worthy of like 1,000 amazing sci-fi books and conversations. Then there's like what this will help us do. Now I've spent 15 years lecturing Fortune 500 companies about exponential technological change. I'm a student of Ray Kurzweil and Peter Diamandis is a friend. Stephen Kotler is a friend who wrote Abundance. Like, the idea, of course, is that human beings have linear brains. And so when we think about change, our intuitive sense of how things change over time is very linear. But for the last 25 years, we've been living in a time of exponential change and digital transformation and whatnot. So even before AI, the vertigo has been there. I mean, I've been speaking to Fortune 500 companies about the fact that, you know, in 25 years, we went from a supercomputer that was the size of a building to a smartphone that is a million times cheaper, a million times smaller, and 1,000 times more powerful, so that a young kid in Africa already has better communications technology than a head of state had 25 years ago. So we're already in that world. We've already lived through that world, you know, and we normalize to it, and it has unintended consequences like social media and all that. But like with this thing now, with AI, like the more it is able to do for us, the more it sort of unleashes a kind of a new skill set, a new literacy that I think it's a form of sorcery, which is really like prompt engineering. You know, as you imagine, so it becomes. This is the very essence of magic. That's number one. Number two, Terence McKenna, the world is made of words. And if you know the words the world is made of, you can make of it whatever you wish. Now, you could argue that words have always changed the world. The right orator can move mountains. But now it's the genie, right? Genie in the lamp. You have to get really good at articulating your wishes, you know? So I'm thinking now with this technology, like if we were smart, we would double down on teaching people how to use this tool by encouraging people to go back to the humanities. Everybody should get a literature degree, a philosophy degree, you know, like everybody should be learning the humanities and enriching their languaging capacity so that they can come back to the AI and then be like, all right, let's dream the impossible dream together, you know, like, because it's, you know, there's this great essay by Henry Munn called The Mushrooms of Language. And he was talking about psychedelics and shamanism and the glossolalia, or not even speaking in tongues, but just like how people in altered states of consciousness, you know, writers will talk about this when they feel like you're channeling and it comes through you, but not from you. And though it is with you, it belongs not to you. This ecstatic vocalization, this enraptured articulation that is possible when we get out of our own way. Now we have a stenographer that can listen to our speech patterns and capture our hypomania and help us realize our greatest ideas in our moments of most intense and exalted inspiration. And it's the best note taker in the history of the world. And then it can execute on those notes. So it sort of collapses the lag time between what we can imagine and what we can create. Every image in my book, by the way, I've never been a visual artist. I've always hired editors. I have really good taste. I'm a good creative director. I don't know how to illustrate. I don't know how to paint. Every single image in this book was a vision in my mind's eye while I was riding my bicycle through the Dutch countryside, high as a kite, and speaking directly into ChatGPT with every single thing I wanted to see in a particular image. So I was dreaming it and articulating it like a creative director and watching it manifest. So like, my direct experience is I'm using a transhuman technology, but it needs to be seen through this lens. If you're just using it like Google, like asking it to answer a simple question, like you're missing the boat, you know? But people often miss the boat. People never realize the power of the tool they have in front of them, you know, unfortunately.
It happens. I mean, how, you know, and I guess this, by the way, you know, the images are unmistakably, you know, AI related, but the chapter heading, I'm looking at a chapter called Astronaut Surfer, and people can fill in the blanks, what it looks like. It's great. Psychedelic Transhumanist is another section, and which is, you know, mind-blowing in all sorts of ways. Just if you take those words seriously, it's also great to hear. Transhumanism was a thing, you know, certainly 15 years ago, and then it kind of faded as people got, you know, people didn't want to transcend anything, or you get mired in. But I guess two questions for you here. When you're talking about all of this, and, you know, incredibly energizing, but there was this, you know, question at Millbrook, you know, the upstate New York compound that for the audience, in case they don't, that Richard Alpert, who became Ram Dass, and Timothy Leary set up, and Ralph Metzner. But there was always this question of, like, who did the dishes at Millbrook? Because they'd have all these people, freeloaders, show up and do a ton of drugs, you know, and have a wild time. But then people had to get fed, and people had to do the dishes. And that kind of started falling apart for various reasons. Like, in this world, who's doing the dishes? Like, and what
the
are
robots.
The
robots?
Okay.
Yeah. The robots will be doing the dish. I mean, here I'm with kind of Elon Musk. You know, I'm bullish that if we get this right and we have a billion humanoid robots, they'll take care of everything. And then we have some kind of universal high income. I mean, I sort of dream about a utopia where the feeling will be like being a university student at a liberal arts college with no curriculum requirements. So it's choose your own adventure, whatever classes you want. And you have a full scholarship. And so it's, and you ride your bike to class.
This is wonderful. But then like, there comes a time when you want to graduate, right? Or like when, how do you build a story out of that?
A scoring?
A story. Like how do you, you know, because like, let's say we have, you know, we're alive, you know, we have infinite lifespans or, you know, a couple hundred years. So it's effectively that.
Would be wonderful.
How do you know? Yeah, I know. I'm looking to live as long as I possibly can. But then,
absolutely.
Like, you know, how do you build adventures? How do you build narratives of meaning if every day is perfect and, you know, and kind of imagined as opposed to like, what's the beginning and the middle and the end?
Yeah. Well, I think we'll sort of create something that's sort of a hybrid between LARPing and live role playing and theater and like making cinema. Like I don't feel like I would want a relative of mine to get a terminal disease for me to appreciate how much I love them. I'd rather see a great film where somebody gets a terminal disease in the film and we can sort of simulate that empathy and experience a dramatic catharsis without requiring us to actually have that real horrific kind of suffering. And I don't know, man, I think music makers and dreamers of dreams, I just feel like creative people will always find a self-motivated meaning-making capacity, like autotelic, things that have meaning for their own sake. Kevin Kelly wrote about this recently. He was like, well, now that everybody can make infinite AI content, how are you going to grow an audience if you're a creator or an artist? And he says, we're all moving towards a world where there's going to be an audience of one. All of us will be able to create amazing things, and we're going to be the only people that see what we make because there's going to be so much stuff getting made.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So he's gone
that.
From 1,000 like, true fans. You can support yourself with 1,000 true fans to now. It's like as long as you're interested in yourself.
Yeah.
Related to this, though, to that question of who does the dishes, where do the kids fit in? One of the things that's interesting about your book is that you talk about, you know, we need to build a world for children. Because if we do that, that centers everything else. But discuss that a little bit because,
absolutely.
You know, this is, I'm thinking back to, you know, this was a classic of the drug war in the late 60s, you know, the hippie couple that, you know, is high on acid and they forget about their kid and they put them in the oven or they eat them accidentally. But always the dream. No, of course it never happened, but this...
Okay.
This is the dream. Yeah. Like, what happens to kids in a world of never-ending adult kind of pleasure, ecstasy, and exploration?
Well, I would hope that people learn how to tune their instrument better. So it doesn't have to be annihilating ecstasy 24 hours a day. It can just be a situation where we're a little bit more present, a little bit more mindful, a little bit less narrowed by survivalist oriented socioeconomic pressures and learning a new phenomenological languaging, a new way of being in the world. I think actually we would pay a lot more attention to our kids and we would marvel at their magnificence and they would continuously move us to tears because of how precious they are. I mean, you see the face of God in a child. I live in the Netherlands a big part of the year, or I spend a lot of time in the Netherlands. And one of the reasons I wanted to put myself here is because here you have a society, now granted, it's a small country, it's a flat country, but they've built a civilization that runs on the bicycle. And there's something kind of incredible about the omnidirectional freedom that you feel in an urban infrastructure and a nature infrastructure that supports the opposite of stop and go traffic, that supports like flow as a kind of baseline human right, like a sense of increased agency and possibility as you move through space that is so safe that it extends itself to the children. And by the way, this was a mother-driven protest movement in the 70s after World War II when the U.S. highway car infrastructure was coming in hard. and they ran over a bunch of kids. And then there was a parent movement against that. And they created this society that feels very much like Elysium. Like from the perspective of the bikeability of this place, you feel like you're in a park. You don't feel like you're in a city. And the children, they get taken around in these like cargo bikes with this like open top front basket, these electric cargo bikes that basically is like the human equivalent of the kangaroo pouch for the baby kangaroo. It's like a second womb, as Joseph Campbell says, a womb with a view. So the children are moving through the world safely held, but with an open horizon. No helmet, no child seat strapping them to the back of the car. They're in the front, open air. And so the experience as a visitor to this place, cycling and seeing these parents with three, four kids and a dog on the basket of their bicycle, I feel like I'm looking at something that's both ancient and futuristic at the same time. It just feels like so cozy, so cute, so normal, so simple. Where's the seatbelt? They don't need it. But at the same time, like a vision of what's possible, a kind of like freedom and relaxation with the way kids move through space. And then it turns out that the data backs my experience, my intuition. Dutch kids are the happiest children in the world for over 15 years, according to some studies, I believe from UNICEF. So it's not just, oh, look how cute these kids look on the bikes with their parents all over the world instead of crying in the back seat. But it turns out that they have more freedom, more agency, more capacity. Yeah. They're like the kids from the Goonies. That doesn't exist in America anymore. You and your friends bike, unsupervised, no helicopter parenting.
Yeah.
And so this is one of the richest countries in the world that's doing something that's a lot better than what other rich countries have done. And if you want to measure the flourishing of a civilization, and I wrote this, you have to measure it by the flourishing of the children. So to that end, I'm like, let's follow the model of the Dutch, you know, and create a world where our children can be as happy and as free and have as much agency as Dutch kids have.
Well, it's a nice intersection with, you know, the kind of free range parenting movement that Reason and has been, you know, intersecting with for a long time. And it's a nice way of, I think it partly is a nostalgia here to, you know, being a latchkey kid. If you grew up at the end of the baby boomer and Gen X, it was more common, you know, and it was seen as a social problem at the time. Like, oh, who's watching the kids from 3 o'clock when they get out of school, and 6 o'clock or whenever the parents show up. Let me ask you another question about politics, though. Let's say, okay, so now we live in this world. And, you know, I think in a way we already inhabit this place. I think you agree with that. But AI is making it more and more real, where you have an infinite number of people projecting their dream world out into reality on some level. What is the system? What's the framework? What's the larger operating system that allows that to happen without one vision taking over everything, or just so much confusion that the operating system crashes all the time?
I think that my emotional response just from hearing what you're saying is, of course, I feel you on that. The epistemic crisis, the what has transpired.
What do you mean by epistemic crisis? Tell me what do
you
mean by that?
Just that people can fall into these like self-reinforcing rabbit holes in social media, where they can fall deeply into outside of consensus narratives about what's true. And while, you know, just like we have a difference between church and state, I also think we can have a difference between facts and like poetic truth or subjective experience, you know, like, but we need to have a framework of agreement on objective facts, which is like, who's doing the maintenance at the air on the airplane for the airline, who's delivering, manufacturing the parts that are making sure that the planes don't crash, you know, like, so it just feels like the conspirituality situation where it's like, maybe people are doing psychedelics, then their own biases are being reinforced by their rabbit holing on social media. And I do miss consensus. And but the thing is, even when we had consensus, you might argue that there was still a select group of people, you know, the heads of the news networks, when we had less news networks, they were kind of deciding like how we're framing the situation, you know, so people give people a place on which to stand. And you know, we can debate this forever. Like, do human beings sort of need that? Like, do we always kind of need a bit of a nanny government that's kind of like not letting us get overwhelmed, you know, not the ontological shock of what we don't actually know about what's going on in reality and whatnot? But, you know, I think these disruptions are going to require for sure a new kind of literacy that I don't know if it can be planned top down. Maybe it's going to be like an emergent situation, you know, we're capable sometimes of like solutions at the level of the organism, you know, like where like the society kind of solves it from the bottom up rather than somebody on the top. This is where I hit my dead end. Like I don't have the solution. But I think what I've tried to do, at least in the book, is articulate the kind of consciousness that is required, the way of thinking that is required, that actually takes inspiration from how AI organizes information. You know, I have a chapter called A New Kind of Mind, where I take inspiration from this idea of Daniel Schmachtenberger, who's a brilliant systems thinker. And he talks about like the intractabilities that we have today have to do with a world where it's everybody's like this or that, my side or your side, thesis and antithesis. And, you know, he talks about like synthesis, which reconciles opposites, but from a higher dimension, you know, and that sounds very poetic, but it's going to mean an ontological awakening. It's going to be like what Stuart Brand was trying to do when he showed us the Earth from space. It's like, hey, remember this whole thing of like countries and lines and cultures, like we made it and we can remake it and we can make it better and we can make it more poetic and we can tap into the good, the true and the beautiful. And we can, you know, like I think of the novel Flatland, you know, and like the idea that this Dot is living in a world where he thinks he knows what's up, and then here comes this thing from this other dimension. So, you know, you'll have to turn to Schmachtenberger where he expands on this idea, but there is something about when things seem intractable and unsolvable, what is needed is a perspective shift that you can't know until it's happened. You can't really imagine it until you're standing on the other side of it, if that makes sense. So we need a breach.
Let me ask you,
awakening.
Yeah. And, you know, on the cover of the book, among the many like slogans that are there, there's liberty, consciousness, ecstasy, which that is. And under that, the only borders are the ones we imagine. So we can, you know, constantly be redrawing these things. I want to ask you, a little bit of personal history. You are from Venezuela. You were born in Venezuela. You then moved to the U.S. You spoke very powerfully when Maduro was removed. But you are an anti-Chavista. Can you talk, like, how does your experience of growing up in Venezuela, which was once one of the very wealthiest countries in the New World, was driven to, you know, immiseration beyond anybody's, possibility of, you know, of seeing that and not being deeply moved by Chavez, by a system, a top-down authoritarian system of brutal repression and of control of individuals and companies and society and everything like that. How does that affect, and on a certain level, I'm like, wow, and you are still talking about ecstasy and awe as opposed to fear and anger and anxiety. But how does your experience of being Venezuelan and seeing the shift in your home country, how does that influence how you are?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was born in Venezuela and so were my parents. Venezuela used to be a country that was so prosperous and welcoming of immigrants. You know, my parents... My father's roots are Spanish and my mother's roots are actually Ashkenazi Jewish. And so they had come to Venezuela and enjoyed great prosperity. My grandfather was a successful, very successful businessman and the sort of patriarch of the family. And so I grew up definitely in great privilege in Venezuela, bilingual, international schools, the whole thing. But even before Chavez, you knew that this system was broken because it was, the immigrant populations that came to Venezuela, they did very well. The native populations, not so much. So there was always like a big chunk of people living in those shanty towns that came from rural areas to the city to look for work and didn't always find it. And so you had a lot of poverty that was ever present and therefore a lot of criminality. dad was kidnapped at gunpoint to have his car stolen for several hours when I was growing up. Our houses had, you know, we had giant walls. The streets had armed guards. I didn't go to sleep one night of my entire life in our very nice house without worrying that there was going to be a break-in. Like, I would get into bed at night every night and be paranoid that there might be a break-in. It never happened in our house, but it happened enough. You heard about this as a regular thing, that you lived with a hypervigilance, you know, and that has caused systemic anxiety for me for all my life. I've battled anxiety. I've had to deal with anxiety that carries over into other contexts, unnecessarily so. I don't live in Venezuela anymore. I left when I was 18. But, you know, I graduated high school in 2000. Chavez got elected in 98. I even remember when he tried to do a coup a few years
right in the early 90s. Yeah.
They canceled school and they were like, yeah, the military's on the street, guns shooting. They're trying to take over the country. So growing up with that fear, you know, America just seemed like the promised land for its like stability and safety. I mean, just the fact that that was not a country where the military takeover was going to happen, right. You know? And so I moved to the US when I was 18 with this story of just, that home wasn't safe, that Venezuela was a disappointment, and that the people at fault were both the elites before that didn't address the systemic issues that gave rise to somebody like Chavez, who was a Robin Hoodian figure, whose appeal was clear because he looked and spoke like the native population rather than the establishment elite that had been the leaders before. And he promised the people, in a way, like a revolution where he was going to take care of their needs and bring social justice or whatnot. And I think the irony is that then he presided over high oil prices and probably brought more money into the country, that if he was a visionary, maybe like the leaders of Singapore, or if he had some of the vision of some of the people in the Gulf countries, could have turned Venezuela into something like that while keeping it democratic, while allowing the free protest of people. But then he, and the irony is, I think that from his own perspective, you know, I think that he really did believe that he was the savior, you know, like the megalomania consumed him and he thought that he was doing the right thing. But of course, we know that then we had political prisoners, we had the shutdown of newspapers, the control of the press, you know, like when people would protest, violence against protesters. I mean, and then, of course, he stole more money than the previous elite stole. So, you know, it's just one of those things where it's just, what do you expect, you know? But yeah, I think it existentially, what it did for me was like, I need something to believe in. I need an existential posture and a way to stand that isn't as depressing as like the country that I come from and the leadership of that country and the people in charge. What does, and I think then, but because I grew up bicultural, you know, I'm in Venezuela, but I'm like listening to music from the 60s because my mom turned me on to that. And I'm reading Alan Watts. And then I have anxiety about mortality and the limitations of human life. But then I read Kurzweil. And so, you know, I think if Freud analyzed me, he would clearly see that all my passions are a direct response to my anxieties. You know, they're like ways to find narratives that provide ways to stand that are nihilistic and depressing. And I think that's all we can do is find the narrative that inspires you to get out of bed in the morning. But what was interesting to me about the narratives that I chose, instead of just like sort of blind faith, is they were data-driven extrapolations. Like I saw the technological progress. I saw how the internet opened up, for example, my career. I had all this success. I saw the opportunity. I mean, I drank the Kool-Aid too. Democratization, access to information, everybody has a voice. I mean, these were real things. And then just business models became wrongly incentivized, you know, maybe because the people in charge didn't have enough consciousness to realize, man, why don't we incentivize this for the better angels of our nature? You know, let's understand human neurochemistry and like make social media systems that like reward people for rising up to the better angels of their nature. We don't have enough poets in charge, unfortunately. We don't have enough people in leadership who are musicians and poets and artists. And I've always felt that those are the people that really need to be like having more influence in some way.
Well, you mentioned Václav Havel, who was imprisoned under communism in Czechoslovakia, then became president and oversaw the peaceful dissolution of Czechoslovakia into the Czech Republic and Slovakia. You also name check a lot and are likened to, and I think for good reason, people like Walt Whitman and Allen Ginsberg. Talk a little bit about them. These are poets, are very, yoked to an America of the mind. What is it about people like Whitman and Ginsberg, that turned you on?
I think there was just, the beat poets in particular. My friend Brad Nessick, who is my collaborator on this series of short films that we're making called The Psychedelic Puppet Show, he's a real student of Allen Ginsberg. And I kind of love that he brought this kind of wild, ecstatic intensity to articulate his yearnings, his alienation, his desire for a communion and connection, and just the love of the written word, like. I just resonate. I mean, for me, these thinkers, they act upon me like lyricists. They act upon me like musicians. When I read their words, when I feel their poetry, it's like T.S. Eliot said, music like poetry communicates before it is understood. So there's just a life force, a hunger, an appetite, an open-heartedness that I resonate with, or that I get entrained with. And I think that I'm trying to do the same thing in some ways with a lot of the videos that I put on the internet. Some people will say, oh my God, Jason, you speak so fast, or I don't always track all the words, but I feel something when I watch you. And I think that's what people are looking for sometimes, is they want a nervous system they can mirror. They want a feeling they can mirror. The infectiousness of the unconflicted man, I'm trying to provide it like an antidote to a lot of the things that I see out there that I don't turn me on,
Just as a final question, I guess, I track with you, very much so, both in terms of temperament and like a lot of the people that I feel have influenced American culture and business and commerce for the better, the people who built out, who envisioned the internet and then built it. And then, it seems to me we're only, a couple decades into this, and people are almost like, oh yeah, now that everybody can talk, like, I want to go back to the way it was. Like, how, people are incredibly reactionary. Like, no, this in the 90s, when I started A Reason in 93, in the 90s, this in many ways is the world we wanted, where more people cross more borders, more people have passports, more people are using drugs and medicines and practices, breathing practices, exercise, nutrition, all like, intentionally. And you have freedom to do that. Many parts of the world don't, but like, and yet in America and in the West, we see people saying like, no, this is the nightmare, and we need to go back to the exact thing that we just destroyed within living memory. How do you get somebody to be like, hey, don't do that. Go forward.
Oh, look, I think that I saw this great YouTube video the other day of how whenever there's a new technology, we try to use it the way we used the previous technology. So he was talking about like when film and the film camera first sort of came on board, we started to make movies that looked like plays. We were basically putting a static camera and filming a play. And we thought, oh yeah, this is a way of like recording a play. And then we found like a new language and a new way of like telling stories, and governed by a whole new kind of internal logic that was developed, a set of techniques that gave us really a new language for subjectivity that was transformative, that continued something that Gene Youngblood calls mankind's historical drive to manifest his consciousness outside of his mind in front of his eyes. And so I think that with AI, some people are using it to like write essays, and some people are using it to like make films and replace films. I'm like, no, we are still figuring out a new kind of thinking with this tool and technology. And that's where I think the essays by people like Kevin Kelly, when he talk about latent space as a new medium, Marshall McLuhan said the medium is the message. I think we need to be thinking latent space tells us that we don't organize the world in categories anymore. We organize it by relations. We don't organize the world in terms of there are no things. There's only relations, regions in latent space where things are related to each other. Relations is the name of the game. And I was like, oh, this is a new way of thinking. And then I thought, well, maybe it's not a new way of thinking. Maybe that's how the artist has always thought. The artist, you know, when you think of what a collage is or what a painting is or when you're making music, like an artist, it doesn't use categories. He kind of works more like latent space. So maybe AI is allowing kind of everybody to now think like an artist. That was kind of like the idea that I was discussing with my friend Brad. And so before we're like, oh, let's go back to the way things were, I think that's a response to thinking that AI is going to be used to replace previous things in a worse way. Oh, it's going to kill movies because it's just going to be AI actors, or it's going to kill writing because it's writing our essays for us. I'm like, that's not good. But maybe we just haven't yet developed the ways to use this technology. They're going to be categorically different. Again, a whole new way of thinking. And then if that happens, then we have a new kind of cognition, perhaps. That's what's interesting to me, kind of like the emergence of language. But it's still unthinkable on the other side of that line, if that makes sense.
Well, we'll know it retrospectively, right? We'll know when we entered this new age that we probably have already been in for, you know, 20 years. So the book is The Ecstatic States of America, A Manifesto for a New Country of the Mind. Jason Silva, thank you so much for talking to Reason.
Thank you.